Now, Dr. Comparé.
Our Father, we thank Thee for giving us again this opportunity that we, Thy children, can gather together in Christian fellowship to become better acquainted with those who are truly our brothers and sisters because the children of God, and to study Thy Word, the most precious thing which we can have. We pray Thou would put Thy Spirit upon us, open our minds, and give us understanding. In Jesus' name, amen. Tonight I want to talk to you about something which starts out way back in ancient history. But of course everything going on today has its roots in ancient history. And while we'll start from the roots, we're going to find that we're getting into a subject that's very much alive today. And that's Egypt. For anybody who may be new to this thing, I'm not going to have time to give you the whole thing, and that's an evening's talk in itself. But the fact is that the people who are spoken of in the Bible as Israel, God's chosen people, are not Jews, never were Jews, but their surviving members today are those whom we usually loosely group as the Anglo-Saxon nations, taking in the people of the British Isles, the Scandinavian and Germanic people, and those of the same race found in smaller scattered groups in a number of the other European nations. And, of course, people who have migrated from those nations and settled in the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa. You cannot understand the Bible if you don't understand that. Because when you try to make the Bible and its prophecies about Israel fit the Jews, it just doesn't work out. You have to either come to the conclusion that God was terribly mistaken, or else that He wasn't talking about the Jews when He made the prophecies to Israel. Now, as I say, that would be a subject in itself for a whole night's talk to give you detailed proof out of the Bible and history on that. So we'll go ahead with that assumption because I've got something further to talk about tonight. In the ancient world, there were a few great empires outstanding because at different times they ruled pretty near all of what was the then known civilized world. One of these was Egypt. The origin of it is lost in legend. Now, they have found evidences of an early primitive culture, late Stone Age, in Egypt, with a dating fairly well given as about 13,500 B.C. But there never has been discovered any evidence of a gradual evolution of a civilization in Egypt, that they worked up by degrees from savagery through barbarism and into civilization. But on the contrary, civilization appears suddenly in Egypt, fully developed, indicating that a people already highly civilized moved in and took over the land at that time. Guesswork is the best you can get as to the dates of anything but quite late Egyptian history. You see, back in B.C. times, you had nothing comparable to the way we have our dates today. This is 1968 all over the world. And it's just as much 1968 in Italy or Germany or Poland as it is here. But in the ancient world, it was never the same date in any two countries. Now, you'll notice even in the Bible, in the historical parts of it, it'll say that something or other happened in the eighth year of the reign of King so-and-so. Well, that's the only way any of them kept their records. Now, they will record that in the fifth month of the 11th year of the reign of King so-and-so, they went to war with some other country. Now, where you can find in the records that are available of those two countries the record of the same war, you will find it was in the 11th year of the reign of the king of one country and the 22nd year in the reign of the king of the other country, so that you can line up their two reigns and find the overlap and thereby tie in those two. The most trustworthy work trying to unscramble ancient history was done by David Davidson, the great authority on the pyramid, because the only way he could prove whether pyramid datings were correct or not was to prove what happened on those dates. And to do that, he had to unscramble these things so that he got the overlap of the Assyrian, Babylonian, and Egyptian records, together with the Bible historical parts. Then he could fill in other dates astronomically, because the records of practically all the ancient kingdoms included eclipses of the sun or moon. Now, we can date those to the exact day. From all these things together, he put together the most trustworthy ancient historical datings that we have found. The Egyptian datings, however, are doubly untrustworthy. You have two sources of them. One, the historical records were kept by the pagan priests of Egypt, and they deliberately falsified a lot of the dates. Now, they were the only astronomers, and to keep their astronomical knowledge alive, but restricted to themselves so the common people didn't get it, they had studied enough to find a number of astronomical cycles. If there was an astronomical cycle of 25,842 years or something like that, they would conceal this in the king list by saying that a certain dynasty of kings reigned 25,842 years. Then, as to the Egyptian monuments, of course, every king of these ancient countries was very conceited about his achievements, and he used to like to leave carved stone monuments telling what he had done. Rarely did his achievements consist of anything except conquering some other city and enslaving a number of its inhabitants. But he would state that in the 8th year of his reign, he captured such and such a city and slaughtered all the inhabitants and burned it to the ground. And in the 14th year of his reign, he captured some other city and he took 22,000 slaves out of it, and so on. But now along comes a later Pharaoh of Egypt, and he doesn't have much to brag about in his reign. So what he would do, he would go to the existing monuments that earlier pharaohs had left and have their names carved off of these stone monuments and his own name put instead. Now, he could do this as to monuments put up by some king who reigned 500 years before. As far as that goes, there were no dates to trip him up, because the only date on anything would say in the 16th year of my reign or the 22nd year or whatever it was, and that could be his own reign just as easily as some other king's reign. So the historical monuments offer some problems. They have to be carefully studied for any physical evidence of changing of the name of the pharaoh on it. Probably the most trustworthy history of Egypt that was ever worked out was that worked up by one of the priests, Manetho, who was specially commissioned to bring order out of chaos and give a true king list. The difficulty is that no copy of Manetho's king lists has survived. The only way you can find out anything about it is that a number of ancient writers quoted portions of Manetho, and they didn't agree on what they quoted. So you will find Manetho's king list quoted with a number of varying dates according to who's quoting from it. You had, of course, in early Egypt, as you had in all the other early countries, not one unified nation, but a number of cities, each one a completely independent tiny kingdom of 1,500 acres or whatever it proved to be. But the first king who really unified Egypt as a nation was Menes. Now you find these varying dates quoted for Menes, from 5900 B.C. down to, I think some of them try to put him as late as 2700 B.C. But the one that has the greatest probability of reasonable accuracy would give the date of Menes as about 4777 B.C. when he became king over all Egypt. And here was a highly civilized nation of that time. This first dynasty, started by Menes, produced the finest sculpture and architectural work of the entire history of Egypt. They were a very highly civilized people. And, by the way, their religion was a pretty high type. They worshipped one god only. It was later that it degenerated into something only one degree above Hinduism. By 4400 to 4300 B.C., in there, animal worship had come in, the worship of the sacred bull Apis and so on. You remember from seeing pictures of various Egyptian temples and monuments, their various gods were all shown with animal heads, jackals, hyenas, birds, and so forth. It takes a pretty bird-brained people to worship a bird-brained god, but that's what they'd become. The Great Pyramid in Egypt, the so-called Pyramid of Cheops, we can't date with precision, but according to all the available evidence, it was built somewhere between 3500 and 2700 B.C. Certain legends say that Enoch, one of the early patriarchs of the Bible, Enoch, was the chief builder of it. Well, his dating would fit into that because the Bible shows he lived between 3383 and 3017 B.C. So that would fit in with the time when the pyramid was built. Egyptian historical records kept by the priests, of course, speak with great indignation of any king who interfered with their debased pagan worship. And this king, his Egyptian name was Khufu, but the Greek historians, who would never call any of these other people by their true name or anything that even the wildest insanity could connect up with it, they called him Cheops. It is just one degree short of impossible to make any sense out of the Greek writings about them, because the only way you can is where they write that some pharaoh did certain things. If you can find a pharaoh who did those particular things, then you know who the Greek writer was talking about, although there's no possibility of connecting up their names. And Cheops, it seems, closed the pagan temples and enforced the worship of just one god during his reign, much to the indignation of the pagan priests. Enoch, if he was the one who was really bossing the show there, would of course have seen to that. Later time, Egypt was invaded and taken over and ruled for a time by people who came out of Palestine and were called the Hyksos, a word meaning the shepherd kings. Now, these varying king lists, as I say, you start with the priestly forgeries, and then you get the various misquotations from them by the other writers. So So the different king lists show dates lasting from over 500 years to a little over 200 years for the period that the Hyksos ruled in Egypt. But probably as reliably as any of them is a 511-year period from 1998 to 1587 B.C. Now, you remember Joseph was sold into slavery in Egypt in 1729 B.C. One of the Hyksos kings was on the throne then. You remember the Bible tells of the 7 years of famine that Joseph prophesied through his dream, and the Egyptian historical records show that they did have 7 consecutive years of famine between 1696 and 1690 B.C. Finally, the Egyptians succeeded in driving out these invaders, these Hyksos kings, and the Bible tells you that a king who knew not Joseph came to the throne and began starting the oppression of the Israelites. Ramesu I, whose name is garbled up by the Greeks as Ramesses, not Ramesu I, Ramesu II, was the first pharaoh of the oppression. He died in 1491 B.C. The Exodus was 1486 B.C. Menephtah was the pharaoh on the throne at the time of the Exodus. Now, in all ancient kingdoms, the time when a king died was a tough period, because any soldier who could get the loyalty of a good part of the army to back him up in an effort to seize the throne stood a good chance of taking it. And you find that many ancient dynasties were started by somebody who didn't inherit the throne. He simply, at the command of a regiment, got in there first and grabbed it, and was then able to get the rest of the army to follow him. Now, the king dies. His oldest son and heir is 14 years old, you'll say. Well, you can see it's just an engraved invitation to any ambitious soldier to take the throne. The Egyptians tried to forestall that kind of chaos. The reigning king would make his oldest son co-regent with him. In other words, you had two kings reigning at the same time. And from the time the boy reached 14 or 15 years old, he was apt to be made co-regent. Now, it's true his father was the boss out of those two kings. He gave the orders and was obeyed. But legally, the son was king the same as his father. And when the father died, the son already was king and stood a little better chance of keeping the loyalty of the army and staying in power. Now, Menephtah, the pharaoh who'd been reigning 5 years at the time of the Exodus, had made his son Seti the first co-regent with him. And the Egyptian histories show that Seti the first did not ever get an independent reign. You remember the Bible tells you of the plagues that God put upon the Egyptians, the last of which, the death of the firstborn of every creature in Egypt, including the oldest son of Pharaoh, and it's confirmed by the Egyptian historical records. Egypt was in Africa, but it was not African in the sense of being Negroid. There does not exist in the earth today a race of whiter white people than the Egyptians during all the thousands of years of Egypt's greatness. Their portrait sculpture is the finest by far left from the ancient world. Now, the Greeks turned out some beautiful sculpture, but a tiny fraction of 1% of it is all that ever was intended to be a portrait of any one person. what a Greek sculptor tried to do was to make a statue showing what a well-muscled person would look like. And he probably modeled the arms and shoulders after one model and had somebody else's model for the legs and so on. And as you look at Greek sculpture, you will notice the faces are uniformly with an expression of blank idiocy that couldn't be made worse. It's not the face of anybody who ever lived and by his experience of living gained the lines of character marked on his face. In fact, practically never do they even bother trying to indicate the pupil of the eye on Greek statues. So it stands there with a totally idiotic, vacant expression. But now, there isn't a statue of that sort produced in all the thousands of years of Egyptian history. The Egyptians believed in resurrection for a future life, and that is why they took the trouble to mummify the corpses of their dead, at least the wealthier ones, because it was a very expensive process. But they knew that even their mummification process wasn't going to keep that corpse intact forever. Nobody knew how long it was going to be until Resurrection Day, and there was the possibility that the mummy might be too badly deteriorated to be resurrected. So, in the tomb of all the wealthier ones who could afford it, you would find, besides the mummy, a beautifully carved portrait statue of the dead man. Now, it wouldn't do any good to put into his tomb a statue of somebody else or just a run-of-the-mill manufactured statue of nobody in particular. The Egyptians said the soul had to be able to inhabit that mummy until Resurrection Day, or if the mummy got too dilapidated, there had to be something else for the soul to go into and inhabit until it could be resurrected. And it could go over into this stone statue if it was his own statue. No point in putting somebody else's statue in there. That wouldn't do any good. Here you had these beautifully individual statues. Now, you don't have to see a Negro's color to recognize him as a Negro. All this story about discrimination against Negroes purely because of their color is not only the worst satanic lie you can find, it's also the most stupid one. The color is the least ground on which we object to the Negro. But if an accurate statue of a Negro is carved out of pure white marble, the Negroid features would enable you to recognize him as a Negro instantly. Now, the Egyptians not only carved statues, which obviously were those of white men, the narrow nostrils and thin-bridged nose, the thin lips, the generally white shape of the face, but also they frequently painted them. And again, they show a white people, brunette, yes. Today we'd classify them as a Mediterranean type race, if you're familiar with modern racial types. But nevertheless, definitely white. Now, Egypt developed in a peculiar way because of her geography. Every place else in the world where a civilization developed, it developed in the midst of a great wide valley or a great wide plain where the cities were open to attack from enemies from all directions. Now, the Nile Valley is a thin strip of land. Well, the cultivated part, the part where there's water enough to grow anything, varies from 1 mile wide in some places to 13 miles wide at the very widest spot. On either side of that is absolutely uninhabitable desert. An enemy would have to be able to carry several weeks' supply of water with him marching on foot across that desert to get in that way. To the north, of course, they were only open to attack by sea, and there were no great naval powers in early Egyptian days that could attack them there. To the south, of course, the Nile River ran on it up into what they called Nubia, and today we call the Sudan, and through that south into Ethiopia. Of course, farther back into the better watered highlands, you were getting into semi-jungle country. Then you got down into desert country with just this narrow watered strip through it. They couldn't come down by boat because south of the border of Egypt were a series of cataracts that a boat couldn't pass. So it was easy to defend Egypt's southern border. Really, the only place they were vulnerable to attack was on the extreme northeast corner where Africa adjoins Western Asia. And that, a small area, well fortified, was pretty easy to defend. You have, therefore, a kingdom with an unusual opportunity to develop its own civilization without interference from any other source and without, indeed, getting much of any other culture from any other source. Egypt went along for some time content to develop its own land. Then you began getting ambitious pharaohs who wanted to reach out and conquer and levy tribute upon other areas. And several times, Egypt ruled way on up the coast through Palestine, on up into Syria, across the northern arch of the Fertile Crescent and clear over to the Euphrates River. Also, in turn, they were conquered and ruled by the Babylonians, the Assyrians, the Nubians for a short period, Persians, Greeks, Romans, and Turks. Neither Assyria nor Babylon, while they defeated Egypt at times and had conquering armies in there for a while and for a brief period were able to make her pay tribute, neither of them were able to keep her conquered very long while Egypt was a white nation. But somewhere around 770 or 775 B.C., they were conquered and overrun by Nubian Negroes, who were in the land for about 75 years. And in that time, Egypt became a mulatto, mongrelized nation. And that was the end of all high civilization in Egypt. Their art went down to very poor, although they had the fine specimens of their early days to copy. From one of the great empires of the ancient world, ruling even to the Euphrates River, they reached the point where any adventurer coming in with a modest-sized army of good soldiers could capture and take over Egypt. Now, you remember that the prophet Isaiah and Jeremiah were warning the people in Israel and in Judah not to trust Egypt. You see, you have the rising great power of Babylon and Assyria, who are reaching over to the coast to conquer and reduce these kingdoms in Syria and Palestine to tributary states. And because Egypt didn't want these powerful enemy armies getting that close, the pharaohs of Egypt were always encouraging these other kings to revolt against Babylon and Assyria. And Isaiah and Jeremiah warned them, don't trust Egypt. Egypt, formerly a white man's country and able to put white man's armies into the field, was now a mulatto nation, and they no longer had the firmness of character or the courage to do it. So the prophet said, you rely on Egypt and you're going to be let down, sure, and so they were. It's interesting to note that in 572 B.C., when Egypt was still quite a powerful country, the prophet Ezekiel gave this prophecy about it. It shall be the basest of kingdoms. Within 50 years after he said that, Egypt had lost its independence, and out of the next 24 and a half centuries, for all but 50 years of that time, Egypt was a conquered vassal state ruled by some invaders from outside. And it certainly has become the basest of the kingdoms. Well, it was ruled, of course, by Turkey up until the time England took it in World War I. And in 1922, England proclaimed Egypt an independent nation, and they put King Fuad on the throne as the first independent king of Egypt since the time of the Ptolemies. So much for getting it down to present days. Now, we know today it's a very little country. It's a very poverty-stricken country. It's a nation of mulattoes, and in every respect, it's thoroughly obnoxious. Now, why are we so interested in it today? Because the Bible prophecies show that we're not through with Egypt yet. Egypt is important not for what it is, but for where it is. It's one of the most strategic spots on the surface of the earth. And that always attracts the great predatory nations who want to rule the earth. And we know who the great predatory nation is now, Russia. So Egypt is part of the present problem. All this sort of thing was foretold by the Old Testament prophets. The prophet Isaiah, Isaiah chapter 19, verses 11 to 14, said this about them. Surely the princes of Zoan, that was one of their principal capital cities, surely the princes of Zoan are fools. The council of the wise counselors of Pharaoh has become brutish. How say ye unto Pharaoh, I am the son of the wise, the son of ancient kings. Where are they? Where are thy wise men? And let them tell thee now, and let them know what the Lord of hosts has purposed upon Egypt. The princes of Zoan are become fools. The princes of Noph are deceived. They have also deceived Egypt, even they that are the stay of the tribes thereof. The Lord hath mingled a perverse spirit in the midst thereof, and they have caused Egypt to err in every work thereof, as a drunken man staggereth in his vomit. Well, that's a pretty fair description of modern Egypt and its accomplishments of the poor sort they are. Stupidly, they drove out the British and stole the Suez Canal from a weakened Britain and France. Thereby, they lost the protection of the only force which might have protected them. They drove out their protector. Then they connived with Russia against the Western Christian nations. They bought vast quantities of military arms from Russia, which they haven't the character and courage to use. Now what do they have to pay for it with? There are only two sources of cash income, other than microscopic and trivial things, in Egypt. One is their cotton crop, and the other is the revenue they get from tolls of the Suez Canal. Now, they bought such vast quantities of military arms from Russia that they had to assign to Russia the entire Egyptian cotton crop for a great many years in advance. It'll probably take them another 10 years of their cotton crop to pay off the arms that they lost in the war of a year ago. But aside from cotton, the only other thing that Egypt produces is mulatto babies. And they've got a big population to feed. They're not able to very substantially increase the area they can cultivate, and they have to import food, and they have to import oil, and they have to import practically all manufactured goods. And for that, they've got to have something to pay for it with. And their one big cash crop, cotton, is gone for a long period of time because it's all assigned to Russia. We have given them vast quantities of American wheat rather than see them starve to death, but you can see the fix they put themselves in. Now, the other source of income, the tolls from the Suez Canal, those have been lost to Egypt for pretty near a year now, that no traffic has been allowed to go through the canal. The Jews are on the east bank of the canal, and they open fire on anything that tries to move on the canal if it's only a rowboat. So that source of income is shut off. Now, along with the military arms, the airplanes, the tanks, the artillery, rifles, and so on, they got from Russia, they brought in quite a large number of Russian soldiers to be instructors to teach them how to use these arms. Well, of course, those Russian instructors are nothing but the advance guard of the Russian army of occupation for the time when Russia is going to take over. And as far as instructing them, what instruction can you give to a man who doesn't have the courage or the character to hang on to his rifle and shoot back when he's under fire? A man who throws that rifle away and runs for dear life. They are fools, as the prophet Isaiah said. Their only chance of survival as a nation, independent nation, came when they were under the protection of Britain, with additional protection from France, because Britain and France between them own practically all the shares in the old Suez Canal Company and would protect it to keep the canal going. So they took away all of that, and now they're left on their own resources, and you see what happens. The Bible, of course, clearly foretells that Egypt is to be part of the Russian conquest as they set out trying to take over the world. The 38th and 39th chapters of Ezekiel tell of Russia's great drive to take over the world. The 38th and 39th chapters of Ezekiel show that when Russia strikes, it'll be a two-pronged fork. One part of their drive will go down east to Turkey through Iran and Iraq and clear on down to the head of the Persian Gulf in order to seize all the great oil fields of the Near East. Then they'll swing west through the Fertile Crescent, on into Syria, down the Palestinian coast, down to Egypt in order not only to seize the Suez Canal, but to get a bridgehead into Africa from which they can go on over into northern Africa. So the Egyptians have deprived themselves of the only possible defense against that attack and have even taken onto their own soil the advance guard of the Russian army of occupation. You remember in Daniel there are some prophecies very difficult to decipher. They talk about the battles between the king of the north and the king of the south. And you have to judge from the way events develop which is the king of the north and which the king of the south. Well, Bible scholars for about two centuries have been able to clearly identify Russia as being the king of the north. and we're still trying to figure out with some degree of certainty who makes up the king of the South. These prophecies in Daniel are hard to unscramble because it keeps talking about how he will make war with him and he will win and so forth, and you can't exactly tell who's he and who's him. But doing our best to unscramble this, you will find references here to this capture of Egypt by the king of the north, which is unquestionably Russia. Daniel 11, verses 40 to 42. And at the time of the end, remember now, this couldn't have happened before our present days because we're just getting into this time of the end now. And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships. And he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. Note that reference to many ships. The Russian Navy had been kept out of the Mediterranean until just the last very few years. And right now, Russia has more fighting ships in the Mediterranean Sea than our entire Sixth Fleet over there. Russia is the big naval power in the Mediterranean Sea right now. He shall enter also into the glorious land, which is presumably a reference to Palestine, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. Definitely, this Russian attack is going to run clear on down into northern Africa. Now, at the same time that they are striking there, because Egypt and Palestine and the Suez Canal constitute the crossroads of the world, at the same time they're doing that, the Bible shows that Russia is making an attack against the United States, coming against us out of the north, over the pole, direct from Russia, rockets and bombers to strike us, and heavy troop movements coming out of eastern Siberia, landing along our western coast. So, with all this going on, Russia is going to make a drive through Egypt. Now, our military men could have told you that some years ago. Daniel told us that 2,400 odd years ago. Now the Bible indicates that when that happens, there's going to be civil war in Egypt.